World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
American tanks and men are swarming across the Brittany Peninsula today, and the cleanup campaign has begun at Brest. Other American columns are turning eastward toward Paris. More than 1,000 of our planes have bombed Berlin and the Hamburg and Kiel areas of Germany. In the east, the Red Army's campaigns against East Prussia and Warsaw are entering the last stage. Berlin says the Russians have made a breakthrough north of the Niemen River. German shells are crashing inside Florence today, but the British 8th Army has planted itself firmly along the Arno on both sides of the city. In the Pacific, a fast American task force operating off the Bornen and Volcano Islands has wiped out a Jap convoy. And now for news on the Battle of France, Admiral takes you to Normandy, Bill Downs reporting.
Senior British staff officers said tonight that the German 7th Army, assigned to hold the Allied troops within their Normandy beachhead, had suffered a major defeat, and that the events of the past 10 days had given the American, British, and Canadian forces in France their first big victory. This high staff officer said that since D-Day, the Allied troops in France had virtually eliminated 13 German divisions, and no army could stand to lose the number of prisoners alone that the Germans have lost to us without suffering a major defeat. The British staff officer paid special tribute to the American forces now roaming Brittany. The Americans have been remarkable in exploiting their gains through very tough country, he said. Then he added, we can learn a lot from them. This high British officer, who is in a position to know the complete picture of the war, painted the most optimistic picture that we have had since we've been here in France. He said that the Germans appeared to be establishing a series of fortress areas around the important Brittany ports, which the American forces are now threatening. The Germans are carrying out demolition in these ports. And in addition to a great land victory, the American tanks in Brittany also have won one of the war's greatest naval victories. The capture of the Brittany port will wipe out Hitler's main U-boat and E-boat bases, and forge a complete change of German naval strategy. However, the Germans are expected to fight bitterly for their now cut-off fortress port. It is impossible to be anything but extremely optimistic at the present stage of the war, the officer said. And then he went on to give his reasons for this optimism. First, on the land front, the Russian advance is threatening Germany itself. In Italy, there are a series of unbroken victories that should continue. The Western Front is going like a house afire. And the resistance front inside occupied France is almost boiling over.
You have heard from Bill Downs in France. And now, Admiral, takes you to CBS London, Richard C. Hotelet reporting.
Spotlight is shifting to another part of the French battlefront tonight, to the area around Mayenne, Laval, and eastward, into which American forces are still pushing. With the cleaning up of the Brest Peninsula now not much more than a tactical exercise, General Bradley is striking out in this new direction. And it's important for several reasons. For one thing, it's another drive. It's not just a few half-tracks on reconnaissance patrol. After taking the towns of Laval and Mayenne, we're moving on in strength. The Germans tonight say that the force that reached Laval yesterday evening consisted of several tank and infantry divisions. This new movement shows that our command is quick on its feet and can change the direction of its thrust, always to go after the major objective. And that we've got the strength to spare for another independent operation. And that's another reason why this move eastward can be very important. For one thing, it's headed straight for Paris. But, much more immediately, if it continues, it can very well outflank the entire German Normandy front. Our thrust seems headed in the general direction of Alençon, which would leave the entire German 7th Army on our flank. And remember, this is happening without weakening the Allied forces that are giving the Germans so tough a time in Normandy right now. In Brittany, there have been no new developments as far as we know. Brest hasn't been taken, and it may be that the Germans will put up a stiff fight for it. Our combat teams are roaming the peninsula at will, it seems. Speaking of Allied strength, we all know that the Americans, British, and Canadians have considerable force in France. So far, we've officially heard of only two armies, Tonight, the Germans report that we have a total of 4 armies in France. And add the American 3rd Army and the Canadian 1st Army to the ones that have already officially been announced. There's no word of the air developments over the battlefront in France today, but 1,000 heavy bombers have hit Berlin, Kiel, and Hamburg before noon today. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Corporation.
When you can see the post-war Admiral two-temperature refrigerator, probably the first question you'll ask is, what's become of the freezing coils? And the answer will simply be, they're gone. At least they'll be gone as far as the eye can see. And you can readily understand how much more storage room for food there'll be in the Admiral. But it means more than that. No freezing coils means goodbye forever to the messy bother of defrosting. Think of never again having to defrost your refrigerator. Actually, of course, the freezing coils aren't gone. Admiral engineers have simply built them between the walls of the refrigerator. When you examine those walls, you'll notice that they are covered with beads of moisture. Gone will be the drying cold that draws the moisture from the air and from the foods in the refrigerator. With Admiral's purified moist cold, foods will stay fresh and wholesome much longer without the use of covered dishes. Remember that. No need for covered dishes. There'll be many more surprises for you in the Admiral 2 temperature refrigerator. Sterilamp with its ultraviolet ray action to kill bacteria and retard mold. A built-in home freezer that will quick freeze or store 2 bushels of frozen foods. These and many more new ideas will make the Admiral post-war refrigerator just as outstanding as Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now here once again is Douglas Edwards.
Within the past few hours, the Germans have been telling of a Russian breakthrough north of the Niemen River defense belt guarding the approaches to East Prussia. The enemy says that heavy battles are raging in that area, but he doesn't locate it further. We do know, however, that the Red Army is ripped into the German flanks guarding the East Prussian coast and the vital sector between Warsaw and Lomza, and that huge enemy pockets in the direction of Krakow have been liquidated. But now to discuss with you the situation on the Eastern Front, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
The situation on the long Russian front has been more or less stabilized for the past 8 days, but now appears to be undergoing some change. In the Baltic states, there are signs that the supposedly trapped northern German army group under Colonel General Lindemann is now withdrawing on a broad front from the Narva Isthmus and the region of Lake Peipus. This, plus the German claim to have retaken the rail junction of Jelgava, south of Riga, may indicate a forthcoming attempt on the part of the Germans to break through the narrow Russian corridor running up to the Gulf of Riga in order to permit Lindemann's 20 to 25 good divisions to withdraw southwestward and join in the defense of East Prussia. If this proves true, it will mark a sharp reversal of the Hitler hold-everything strategy. On the East Prussian front, the Russians are advancing, slowly, against a German resistance which is termed fanatical. The Russians do not yet officially claim any crossing of the German frontier, though they are very close to it. The axis of the Russian advance seems to be directed toward the so-called Insterberg Gap, between the River Niemen and the Masurian Lake. This is the traditional weak spot in the defense of East Prussia. In the Warsaw area, the Russians suffered a sharp check during the past week, their advance elements east and northeast of Warsaw running into heavy German resistance in front of the Narev River line. The Germans claimed that some Russian forces were cut off, but increased Russian pressure northwest of the town of Shadlesee seems to be restoring this situation and may soon again bring the Russian pressure directly against the east bank suburbs of the Polish capital. This is a position of considerable anxiety, for Polish underground resistance in Warsaw itself has flamed high, and we must hope that it is not premature. There has been no considerable Russian crossing of the Vistula River south of Warsaw, as far down as the confluence of the River San at the town of Sandomierz, which is still in German hands. Southwest of Sandomierz, however, the Russians have effected a crossing of the Vistula, which is, at the moment, beginning to threaten the old Polish capital of Krakow. In this region, a powerful German counterattack seems imperative if the Germans are to prevent the expansion of the Russian bridgehead and the eventual outflanking of the Warsaw area from the south. It remains to be seen whether Field Marshal von Model, the commander of the German forces in this area, disposes of sufficient force to deliver such a counterstroke. Still further south, the Russians have made local advances in the Carpathian region, which threaten the Galician oil fields, an important source of German petroleum supply. Now here again is Douglas Edwards.
Berlin Radio says that Adolf Hitler has made another speech, this one on Friday, before a gathering of high party officials. The broadcast disclosed that Hitler, in appealing again for full party loyalty to himself, admitted that anti-Nazi generals had been sabotaging his regime ever since he came to power 11 years ago. The Germans are still pouring shells into the historic city of Florence. And now for details of the fighting in Italy, Admiral takes you to Rome, George Murad reporting.
It's a beautiful summer evening in Rome, just before the dinner hour. The Borghese gardens are crowded with Allied troops, flirting with pretty Roman girls. People are promenading by the old Spanish steps. There's good food, music, and fairly good wine at the big hotels.
We regret the interruption of our broadcast from Rome. Here are further details of the situation on the Italian front. Bullets are whistling through the ancient streets of Florence today, and the Germans, despite promises to respect the Tuscan Arts Center as an open city, are pouring heavy artillery fire into the southern sections where the British 8th Army is deployed. The London radio said that Florence is virtually in our hands, with the city something of a no-man's land. The broadcast, as heard by the Columbia shortwave listening station, said that South African troops have thrown pontoon bridges across the Arno River, flowing through the city, to replace those destroyed by the retreating enemy. Allied headquarters says that British artillery has not been turned against the northern district, containing the bulk of Florence art treasures and where strong German forces have taken a stand. On both sides of the Florence, the 8th Army planted itself firmly along the Arno River, and the position of those German forces still south of the formidable stream is considered untenable. The enemy, raining long-range 6.5-inch shells into the part of Florence which lies south of the Arno, is firing from good mountain positions north of the city. Small arms fire was exchanged inside Florence across the Arno. Most of the shooting came from buildings demolished near Ponte Vecchio, the only one of the city's historic bridges left intact by the retreating Germans. On the Adriatic end of the Italian front, the Germans are drawing back toward Rimini, the eastern coastal anchor of their Gothic line, with Polish troops in pursuit. The Poles have captured the villages of Brunietto, Monte di Ripe, and San Vito, 2 or 3 miles beyond the Misa River and some 40 miles south of Rimini. Bringing up their forces all along the line, the British have sent patrols into Empoli, some 15 miles west of Florence. From Florence westward to the sea, the stage is being set for the Battle of the Arno. On the western end of the river line, American patrols have crossed the stream and probed enemy positions, returning after several hours behind German lines. A German patrol trying to infiltrate American positions was wiped out. The Germans were firing on the southern sections of Pisa on the lower Arno with artillery and mortars. The Arno is a military obstacle of importance from Florence westward. The bed is 250 to 600 feet wide. Within Pisa and Florence, the river flows between masonry banks averaging about 20 feet in height. 8th Army units strengthening the Allied line between Florence and the Adriatic have seized Bibiano in the upper Arno River Valley, about 27 miles east of Florence and nearby Monte Grillo. There has been a new naval engagement in the waters off Tokyo. For a first-hand report on this battle and an interview with the correspondent who has just returned from the Marianas fighting, Admiral takes you now to Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
In a communique just released, Admiral Nimitz has announced that air and surface units of a fast carrier task force on the 3rd and 4th of August virtually wiped out a Japanese convoy and raided airfields, towns, and ground installations in the Bonin and Volcano Islands groups. We lost from enemy anti-aircraft fire 16 planes and 19 flight personnel. Just returned from the Marianas is John Bishop, war correspondent for the Saturday Evening Post. He arrived at Saipan on D-Day, covered that operation, went on to Tinian on D-Day, and was there during that swiftly developing operation. John, what's the word?
Well, Tinian has been a bit overshadowed by Guam. But Tinian is an extremely important island. Has the most valuable airfield in the Marianas, with paved runways and well-built dispersal areas. Tinian was a very necessary island for us to take. It was taken in 9 days in a smooth and beautifully coordinated operation from veteran Japanese troops who are well-equipped and smartly led.
Was it as tough as Saipan, John?
Well, they really shouldn't be compared. At Saipan, due to the rugged terrain, the fighting was very mean. But on the other hand, at Saipan, the landings were made over thousands of yards of beach. While at Tinian, all our forces were funneled through a very narrow beachhead, narrower even than Tarawa. I believe it is the narrowest beach area ever used by our invading forces.
Well, how do you account for the success under those circumstances?
Because through the masterful tactics and organization of forces by Rear Admiral Harry W. Hill in command, the 4th and 2nd Marines achieved almost complete surprise. The Japs were expecting us at the wide beaches in front of Tinian Town, at the other end of the island, where they had concentrated their main defenses. This northern landing was, to me, a masterstroke because it saved many American lives. Another advantage of the northern landing was that it allowed us to mass our artillery on Saipan across the 2.5-mile channel to give heavy shellfire screen for the assault troops.
Could you see them over there on Saipan?
We certainly could. The artillery was lined up over there, almost hub to hub, for the better part of a mile. We watched the flashes run up and down the shore like strings of giant firecrackers. At the same time, a ring of battleships, cruisers, and destroyers blasted important targets all over the island, and Thunderbolts and Mitchell bombers were shuttling back and forth from Saipan in a steady stream. Some of the planes took off, accomplished their missions, and were back at Isley Field loading up again in about a quarter of an hour.
What was the nature of the Jap resistance?
Their first show of real resistance was at dawn of D-Day plus one, when about 2,000 Japs put on one of their suicidal banzai attacks. The Marines had so quickly consolidated their lines that the Japs were cut to pieces in short order. Very nearly all of the 2,000 were killed. From then on, with our many tanks operating in wonderful tank country, the Marines simply overran all resistance until the Japs made their final stand on the high ground at the south end. There was some pretty rough fighting toward the end. In this amphibious warfare in the Pacific, taking an island like Tinian may be compared in importance to the taking of one of the great fortress cities in the European conflict.
You've heard John Bishop, war correspondent for the Saturday Evening Post, just back from the battlefront in the Marianas. And thank you, John. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
There is another item from the Pacific today. From Tokyo comes this grim piece of news. All Japanese civilians are soon to be armed to fight in defense of their homeland. The enemy's decision to wage a total war was contained in a cabinet agreement, and the decree seems to reflect Japan's fear of an imminent invasion of her home islands. Fears were not lessened by a subsequent American announcement that Lieutenant General Robert Richardson's Army Command of the Pacific Ocean Areas has been extended westward to the Japanese mainland and beyond. And now for a glance at the top developments here at home and an interview with American flyer who has taken part in operations from Italian bases, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
Philadelphia's strike-bound transportation system has begun operations again for the first time since last Tuesday, although it's still not on a full normal schedule. The Army has ordered all the men back to work by midnight tonight. Here in Washington, the Senate will begin debate Tuesday on unemployment compensation measures, a part of the reconversion schedule. One bill, introduced by Senators Truman, Murphy, and Kilgore, provides for payments up to $35 a week. Another, which has the approval of the Finance Committee, headed by Senator George, proposes to leave the whole matter up to the various states with federal aid. A hot fight is expected over that issue. Military officials here are alarmed about the recent lag in war production and are fighting a WPB order to authorize partial civilian production beginning August 15th. Probably the most important air power development since the war began is a long-range fighter plane, the Mustangs, Lightnings, and Thunderbolts that have been escorting big bombers everywhere in Europe. Here's a man who's been flying those long missions, Lieutenant Colonel Alvin C. Gillen, 2nd of Columbus, Georgia. What were you flying, Colonel?
A Mustang, a P-51.
Well, what was the longest flight you ever made?
Well, I've been over the oil fields of Ploesti, Romania, 4 times, and I've been to Vienna, Austria, Toulon, France, and Bucharest, Romania.
Oh, where was your base?
At Foggia in southeastern Italy. We moved down there after the beachhead was established at Anzio. We had to cover that first.
Oh, yes. I want to ask some questions about that a little later. But first, how about these long flights? What impressed you most?
By the time we got back from each flight, the thing that had impressed me the most was the seat. We were off in the air for 6 hours at a time. Otherwise, I guess the most impressive thing was a German flak. Around places like Ploesti and Vienna, it was so thick you could walk on it.
Well, Colonel, just how can you stretch the range of a little fighter like the P-51 so that it will cover so much territory?
Well, we use belly tanks for extra gas and drop them as soon as they're empty.
And you still have enough left for a fight if necessary, huh?
Oh, sure. And incidentally, the P-51's one of the sweetest fighters in the air and one of the toughest. One time over Toulon, I got a burst of flak in my motor. All the way home, I thought it would conk out any minute, but it never did.
Well, Colonel, on an average long-range mission, about how many fighters would you have?
Well, I could hardly tell you that, but I can say that we're flying P-51s. We always felt that we could take on just about any force that Jerry's cared to send up. We had 15 or 20.
Well, did you run into very much fighter opposition?
It was spotty, sometimes very light and sometimes plenty thick. Before we left the base, each of us would put a couple of dollars in a pot to be given to the highest scoring team when we got back.
Well, we mentioned the Anzio beachhead a while ago. I suppose that was the most exciting job you've ever had, wasn't it?
In some ways. Mostly it was hard work.
Well, Colonel Gillam was in command of the only planes that operated from the beachhead when it was the most heavily bombarded spot in the world. What was your assignment?
We had to be ready all the time to intercept any German planes that came over. We flew right off the beaches within artillery range of the Germans.
Well, that must have been a nice, restful experience.
Well, we didn't get much sleep, but then neither did anyone else. I'm grateful for the experience, though, because it opened my eyes to the hardships the infantry has to put up with and fight through. We usually have it pretty easy at our bases, and we seldom get a chance to see foot soldiers in their foxholes, always wet and dirty and always under fire. Gave us all the respect in the world for the plain GI.
Did you get very much action at Anzio?
Plenty, usually about 3 combat missions a day. We were flying British Spitfires in. The Germans were sending over the best they had. It was our job to keep them away from the beaches where our ships were unloading constantly. It was lively enough, all right. I flew practically 2/3 of my 90 missions while I was there.
Well, now, after 13 months abroad, I suppose it's pretty good to get back with your wife and daughter for a while.
Wonderful.
Well, I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In Montana, Major General Louis B. Hershey, the National Selective Service Director, has expressed the belief that all eligible high school boys in the nation will eventually be in the armed services, regardless of whether or not the war with Germany is ended. General Hershey told a news conference, "I can't speak for the Navy or War Department, but in my opinion, the high school youth of America who are militarily acceptable will see service in the armed forces after the war in Europe is cleaned up. There are a lot of doughboys and other American soldiers who've been in this thing for 4 years. I think, said Hershey, they'll be waiting to come back home." The general said there is little prospect of a rapid demobilization. It took 30 months at 1,000 men an hour to go from a little over 1 million men to a striking force of 11 million. Demobilization will be slow. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
During the 7 years before Pearl Harbor, Admiral Corporation advanced from 52nd to 4th place in the production of radios for the home. That's a typically American success story with a surprisingly simple formula. Admiral has always given the buying public just what it wanted. When people complained about unsightly aerial and ground wires, Admiral designed a built-in aeroscope. When more convenient tuning was desired, Admiral originated tilt tuning with a soft glow dial, easy to read standing or sitting. When radio phonographs gained popularity, Admiral gave America a dependable, trouble-free, inexpensive automatic record changer. Again, the response was so great that Admiral soon became the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. In supporting America's war effort, Admiral has led in research on radio, radar, communications equipment, and television. So, when America's enemies have surrendered, Admiral will give you just what you'll be wanting in your next radio or television receiver. You can always expect the best of everything from Admiral. The Fifth War Loan has drawn to a successful close, but the need for all of us to buy war bonds, more and more of them, has not ended. Our boys in Italy, Normandy, and the Pacific need your help today just as badly as they did last week or last month. Remember, too, the road to post-war financial security for you is paved with war bonds. So, if for no other reason than its personal advantage to you and your family, buy all the war bonds you possibly can. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, and post-war makers of Admiral Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Chicago.